Welcome to the My Ministry Mission podcast, where faith's transformative power comes to life. Be sure to check out this episode's show notes. And if you enjoy this topic, head on over to myministrymission.com to find out how to join our community or even become a guest. God has placed a calling to ministry in my heart, and I'm answering that call. My name is Jason, and this is my mission. Thank you for listening and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Jason McConnell. There is quite a crisis happening in the lives of some of the most sincere, hardworking, Jesus-centered people you might ever meet. And no, it doesn't look like rebellion, and it doesn't look like walking away from God. From the outside, it actually looks like faithfulness, but on the inside, something is slowly shifting. Closeness to God has been replaced by usefulness to God. Abiding has quietly given way to achieving, and what began as a calling has started to feel more like a performance. Today's guest knows that territory way too well, from the inside and out. Eric G. Reed is an author, publisher, and co-founder of Skinny Brown Dog Media. He has spent over a decade helping purpose-driven authors share their stories with the world. But the book he's been writing, Leadership Was Never My Calling, is the most personal one yet. And no, it's not a leadership manual. It's a confession from someone who has chased position, discovered it couldn't hold what he was carrying, and is letting Jesus reform him around something better. Abiding instead of striving, hiddenness instead of recognition, faithfulness instead of followers. Do I have your attention? If so, be sure to check out lwnc.net for more information, and I'll be sure to put that link in the show notes, as well as Eric's social media and whatever information I find about him. So be sure to check that out. Are you ready to meet today's guests? Welcome, Eric, and thank you for joining me on My Ministry Mission.
Hey, thank you. I love the summary, by the way. Well done. I was like,
oh, thank you,
what
sir.
What was he talking about? Then you got to my name, and I was like, oh, that's me.
It's me. Right on. I love it. I always like to give the listeners an opportunity to get to know you, and I like to start with a favorite Bible verse. You actually gave me three, but I'm going to go ahead and jump into John 15:5. I love that verse. It's, I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. How is this meaningful to your faith journey?
It's one of those verses that you can read through and be like, oh, we're talking about agriculture. Or we're talking about, you know, great tomato harvests in the fall. And over time, as I read it, I'm like, limited. Fruits only occurs by being in proximity, by being connected. And I had fallen into this leadership development, leadership thing where I said, well, I'm going to plant my own vineyard. I'm going to create my own vines. They're going to go out and transform and impact and do all these amazing things. And I kept feeling this is like, why is this not bearing fruit? Why does it feel like I have a whole lot of vines, but nothing is really bearing fruit? And the fruit that it might be bearing just doesn't have that sweet, you know, keeping it in the wine analogy, that sweetness, that flavor, that center of the earth. And so when I think of that verse, it's a lot about like, wait a minute, you were trying to outperform God with your own vineyard, right? Your own vine. And you would have been so much more successful, Eric, had you just abide. Like, abide in me. Like, just cling to me. Hang to me. It's not a symbol of weakness. It's not a symbol of codependency. It's a statement of, if you want this, then this is where it starts. And so I often will picture, I'm a kind of a visual thinker. And so I'll picture, it's like, okay, are you planting or grafting? into,
ooh,
into
God question.
Or into other people that, you know, are you finding the God in other people and grafting into that or grafting into God and his word? Or are you out trying to plant a whole new thing? And so that's kind of why I like it, because again, being a visual person, I can see it makes perfect sense on the physical level. So why wouldn't it make sense on the spiritual level?
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. That's a really good answer. And in case somebody is thinking, what is this Christianese that's being used? Abiding is basically being obedient, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, if that's the simplest way to explain
it. And we could do theology and translations. But to me, when I look at that visual, abiding is grafting into. It's like burying your roots inside something else. It's not that discipline at a distance. It's not that obedience at a distance. Mm-hmm. It's in agriculture, it's grafting into. It's becoming one with and drawing all your nutrition, all your resources from that join point, because you don't have access to the roots. You don't have access to the water, to the nutrients and all. You have to depend on that main vine. And so when I see and I think about it, it's a conscious, repetitive action, leaning in and drawing from, instead of waiting to be gifted or told. It just feels different when I change the visual for the word.
I like that. Absolutely. So let's start kind of simple, getting to know you. What does a regular morning look like for you?
I'll let you know when I have one.
Sure.
I have two woods. They are 17 and 15, soon to be 16. And they're bus. They ride separate buses. Did my daughter's on the special services bus or special ed bus or whatever we call it these days. But they get up between 5 and 5:15, so they can be out the door between 5:45 and 6 a.m. So that they're home at 2 o'clock, which is kind of crazy because it's like I'm just getting momentum for my work day and they bust in through the door. So that first hour of every day is really just about getting them out the door, getting that morning routine starting for them. And I am, since pretty much day one, I would be at the bus stop with them before the bus pulled up. And only this year I've been asked to stay in the house. Like my 17-year-old, he's like, Dad, you don't need to come and stand with me. And I'm like, but I want to. So we kind of do it, you know, in the foyer before he goes out the door. Because, you know, I save embarrassing him for more important moments.
That's so fair. Yeah.
It is that making sure that their morning starts with somebody in it that cares and values and, you know, that gives them that, like, you matter moment. And in the middle of that is a Husky and a German Shepherd and a Chihuahua running around looking a matter of moment. So once they clear out and the house returns to stillness, that's when I return to stillness. It's like, okay, got him out the door, said, you know, Lou, keep them safe, God, bring him home. And my first instinct was always to, okay, go get your devotional, get your Bible study, you got to get it. And I was like, wait a minute, that sounds like a daily work. Like, I understand discipline and consistency, but today I don't feel like it. And I struggled with that too. Like, well, it's not a matter of feeling. It's part of, like, your mental, your physical, your spiritual health. There's things you'd... And he was like, well, do you just have a minute for us to just sit here? Like, it's a beautiful morning. I'm sitting on the porch. I'm just enjoying watching the morning wake up. Do I really have to run inside and try and finish the 2-page devotional right now? And so I've let go of those 5 a.m. warrior kind of attack spirits And I said, you know, just unfold it for me, Dad. Just unfold it for me. And before I hit my work desk, there is always it's kind of my beck and people sometimes come up with their word of the day or word of the year. Mm-hmm. And I was struggling. I was not getting a word. Mm-hmm. I was telling Walt, it's way behind schedule. It's mid-January. I have to order the bracelet, the poster, and start writing it down 3 times a day. That's what the book says. And it wasn't until maybe February. It was like, look, Eric, just flat out, can't see speaks in the shut up terms. Just put your hand on your plow in your field, and I'll take care of the rolls. And I was like,
yeah,
I don't get that. Like, it's supposed to be a word. Now you've given me. But it is that, Eric, all I'm asking you to do is take what I've given you today, your talents, your gifts, or the assignment in front of you. Put the hard work in. Stay focused on where you're at, not what your competition is doing or the guy that you want to try and beat on. Just stay in that. Do it for that. And the rest, dude, I've got to cover.
Yeah.
So I like that. That's kind of my morning. Some days it has scripture. Some days it doesn't. Some days it has just sitting to the same song on an endless loop, letting it just sort of teach and speak to me. One day it's sitting in the backyard trying not to have coffee spill about me as the dogs jump up on my lap.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the going out at the bus stop. So my daughter's never ridden a bus. For elementary, middle school, she was at a charter school. They didn't have a bus. High school, she's at a high school that's not really in our area. But it was a better option anyways. But when she transitioned from elementary to middle school, that's when life changed. That's when peer pressure kind of, you know, the how do I look in the eyes of my peers changed. And you know, first, second, third grade, it was always, you know, we'd get out of the car, big hug, love you, bye. Well, come middle school, first day of middle school, no more hugs, right? We're done. She's like, Dad, I love you. I got to go. Okay. I'm trying to reconcile it, but I'm okay. So this goes on. I get used to it. And then one day, because we have a dog too. Dog's always takes a ride to the school with us. One day she turns around and reaches in like with one hand. And I'm like, it's happening. We're getting the hug. I'm getting the hug. It's happening. And I go to reach for a hug and she reaches past me and pets the dog. She looks at me and goes, what are you doing? And I'm like, I thought you were going to hug me.
So it's, again, a 17-year-old boy, I used to get a hug pretty much every morning. I still get an I love you, but I got a hug pretty much every morning. And he is not a morning person. Like, if the stove light is on, it's irritating. But I think that's all 17-year-old boys in general. So now I'm like, dude, what do I get today? A side hug? Like, I need to connect with you before you go out the door. So we kind of like shoulder bump or side hug. But I will still walk up to him and I'm like, I need this. He's like, what? And I'm like, you know. And he's like, oh my God. Oh, Dad. He does all that noise making. And he stands up.
Yeah.
And I get a hug. I take a hug from him. I'll say, thank you. I needed that. Because it's not always for him. It's for me. And I'm allowed to say I need it because it also gives him permission to come to me and say, I need a hug. I need one-on-one time. When he was little, he used to say, I need little. He said, you little me? I was like, and it meant just bring him back in baby position as close to the other side. So I really, when I say force, I don't force my hug. I would never do that. But I tell him, I need this. I need to just give it to me.
And
he eases into it. So feel free to tell your daughter, I just need it today. I'll get it.
That's fair.
I just need it. Because she'll know how to ask for it when it's her turn.
I like that. That's fair. Yeah, the hugs aren't a problem. I mean, she's, you know, it's just right there in front of the school. It's not a thing anymore.
When I went in there with my son, I run down on Red Lacrosse Field and I got marbles at home. Oh, God. The funny thing is, there is a kid somewhere in his proximity that says, I would die for that moment.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Me giving it to my son only lets him know that there are people that feel and do that. And hopefully they seek those people out. And if they seek me out and say, only if it was friends, they can have one.
Absolutely. Love it. All right. So one more quick question, and then we'll jump into a little deeper conversation. If you could go back and have just like a 10-minute conversation with the version of you who first started all the chasing, what would you say to him?
Really? You're enough. You're loved. You already own that. The problem you're having right now, Eric, is you don't think it's enough and you don't believe it deep enough that you think you have to add on top of it. And my son is, I should be a preacher because I've got material with him all day long. My son, I will turn and say, I love you. And he says, okay. And that used to annoy me to no end. I would just like, what is this? And what I slowly realized was he is so confident and so secure in hearing that and receiving it that he doesn't feel this need to tennis racket it back and say, love you too. Or like, he just receives it and he's like, okay. Like, okay, thanks for the thanks for the tap on the shoulder reminder. I wish old Eric, and still some days current Eric, could receive that kind of love or attention or you're enough and just go, okay, thanks. Like, I can sit in that and not feel as if I have to perform to get it the next time.
Yeah, that. So you described your faith journey, I believe, as a long, long obedience with some detours. Curiosity, of course, could you take us into one of those detours? I mean, what was that season like from the inside perspective?
I don't know if like all detours, you take it thinking it's a shortcut. And you end up like miles away at an empty tank and you try and figure out, oh, please tell me there's a gas station. For me, it was going back to that. Just you is not enough. You need to do this, make this, have this, fill this, create this. Like you need to like really do. I grew up in the Midwest. My father is a German Lutheran mechanical engineer. He had charts and graphs for pretty much everything. And so as a kid, we kind of, without criticizing him, but his love language was check boxes on a spreadsheet. Like, oh, yay, you did that check.
Okay.
Oh, yay, you did that check. And so I grew up trying to fill out as many check boxes as I could. Because that told me I was valuable, that I was loved, that I was doing the manly right thing. And so even today, sometimes it'll slip in when a client says, could you just mail me this? I mailed three extra things because I want to make sure if there's extra checkboxes, I've got them covered. And so in doing that, I became focused more on the performance and not the presence and being with the person and being with God. I was
it makes sense.
The number one everything, but I was so far away from the vine that it was just like, it was like burning in the sun. I mean, I was just, why is this not going? Why am I always fighting? Why am I always struggling? Why do I feel exhausted doing all this God work? And he basically said, because you're really not doing what I asked you to. Like you're swimming upstream, trying to get to the headwater when if you just stayed in flow and stayed in listening, like stayed faithful and dutiful, you would go so much further and I would take you where you need to be. And so in that, constant exhaustion and reinventing and trying to become more re-faithful. Like, what does more faithful look like? Hey, you know, well, I'll just do two devotionals a day, or, you know, I'll do it in King James and Living Word. It was just like, you're still trying to perform instead of being present, which is an easy thing to do because presence requires a bit of humility, a bit of sitting quietly and letting go and surrendering. And nobody wants to surrender. We say we surrender, but we don't. We do fake surrender. Like, oh God, I surrender this to you because I've done everything and I've run out of resources, so I'm going to tear us. No. That's not surrendering. That's forfeiting. That's abdicating. That's tossing off responsibility. As a visual person, if an army came into my house and I committed to surrendering, they would own my family and could sell my family. They could do whatever they wanted with each of my children. They would own everything within my sight and beyond. They wouldn't just own the gun that I had been using to fight against them. And so that full surrender, well, I'm not sure I've done it yet. I'm aware of what the costs.
I've had similar thoughts. It's like, I don't know if I'm, you know, I talk about it on this podcast, but I don't even know if I've made it that far. Well, maybe some days. We'll see.
And again, the language for me, the language is always important because I'm a writer and it's what I do. It's like he was using terms to speak to a group of individuals who, from an education level, may have been our equivalent of elementary school. They may have been versed in the law. So he had to use stories. He had to use common language. He had to use things they could visualize because that's how stories stay. And so when he said surrender, he meant you had been an invaded people for all of history. And you know what surrender feels like. You know what the morning after surrender looks like. I need you to see that in your life as it relates to me and our relationship and all of that. It wasn't just toss me the bad stuff and I've got you covered.
Yeah. Reminds me of Psalm 46:10. Be still and know that I am God. It's so hard to do.
And that means still in spirit, still in thought, still like it, you can't be still sitting in a chair, but planning what he's going to do.
Right.
Well, a couple of years ago, we had cancer. My spouse was going through cancer treatment and everybody's like, I'm praying that they, you know, receive a healing. And I struggled with that because I would say, I don't know if I want you praying for us if you already have the objective in hand. If you've already determined the course that God has to take, I'm not sure. Like, I was struggling because another part of me is like, yeah, I'm praying for healing too, because I am not doing this alone.
Then.
Faster in 5 minutes. But it's like saying, you know, God, I'm willing to get on the highway with you as long as we get off at exit 99, not 101.
Right.
And so it really became, for me and those who were willing to ask what I needed, I just need for you to pray for restoration, restoration of faith, restoration of trust, restoration of like all of those things that get lost in a difficult season. Just restore it and recenter it in our family. Because if there's not a healing, we're going to need a new level of hope. We're going to need a new level of family, community, connections that might have gotten broken, might be broken. And so this is who I am. I have to surrender the hope that there will be a healing. Now I can say, you know my heart, God, and you know what I need and what I want and the season I'm in. But to pray for healing is not surrendering it all. It's surrendering it all as long as it ends up at this point.
Yeah, it's a new, unique way to put it. And I kind of feel that segues into another topic I'd written down is, you've used the phrase, Jesus reforming me around ordinary. And I mean, what does that actually look like? You know, what does ordinary obedience look like for, and maybe it's individualized, maybe it's not, maybe there's a general ordinariness, but, you know, trying to wrap my mind around, what does that actually mean?
Anybody that has parents probably knows what it feels like to be ordinary in a moment that you're trying to feel special or unique, or, you know, in the book I talk about, I hosted an event. It was called Live to Lead. I'm a part of the John Maxwell Organization. So it was a group of like-minded speakers, and I had managed to get the university to basically donate the auditorium and donate the equipment. We were flying. God is just blessing. Like, we were just moving through. Nothing is slowing us down. And the day of the event, I'm on stage, and it was really kind of early in my whole thing. But I give the welcome and the opening, and I introduce the first speaker. And I'm running off stage, just like, oh my God, but I did, you know, I'm so proud of myself. And I get in the lobby, and a really good friend of mine, a dear, dear friend, she is the most, couldn't be a better person in my life at the time. I'm like, I can't believe it. I did it. I think I was going to pee my pants. I so thought I was, and I'm like, you know, acting like a 16-year-old. And all of a sudden I see this sound guy walking across the lobby, waving his hands. I thought he was like applauding me silently, not to interrupt. Apparently my mic was still on. Everybody in the auditorium heard this. I thought I was gonna pee. As funny as it is now, I still had a whole day of going back up on stage and introducing speakers, doing like Q&A. Like, I had 6 hours left, and at the last impression they had of me before my next appearance was, I thought I was gonna pee. A moment like that sort of helps you realize, like, you know what? We used to say when I worked for campaigns, don't buy your own press, because you wrote it.
Right.
That you can get caught up in your own social media feed of great meals and happy moments that you become so far away from yourself and the things that matter that sometimes you got to have a I almost peed moment for Dalton Gropa. I can take you out anytime I want. I can bring you back to humble anytime you want. And so slowly in those moments, I started being like, you know what? Ordinary. What does it look like to be present without a mic? To be present without an agenda? To be present because I just happened to be in the room 10 minutes early and set up the chairs and then just take one instead of making sure everybody knew who the chair setup guy was that day. And first, it was so much, the pressure to perform was so much less. It was like, I set up the chairs right. Good job, Eric. But it also was like, you know, that felt good just to do it and not have to worry about a checkbox. And so, slowly, it was those ordinary things that made me feel good about myself, about the serving people, and not worrying about how it was received. And so, the reform is really like, and I use again in the book, he had this whole table of people. He was like in his moment on stage when that Last Supper was occurring. He could have levitated the table and switched the seating order if he had wanted. And it would have been expected because he's Jesus. He's everything. So he gets up, walks around the table, takes off his tunic, grabs a towel and a basin, and walks over and washes somebody's feet. It's like, this is your Oscar moment. This is like standing in front of the Academy, and that was what you chose to do? Eric, you've got it all wrong.
Yeah.
And that is sort of the whole awareness that I had to figure out again, because I had started wanting to do that, but then I became consumed in all this other stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, Jesus not only washed their feet, that was, you put some context to that, it has such, so much more significance. You know, that was probably the lowest of low jobs. My understanding is that they wouldn't even let, you know, a Jewish servant wouldn't do that. It would be a Gentile servant.
And again, in part because if you're at that table and it's Shabbat or Sabbath dinner, there's days of preparation that go in because you're not allowed to cook on that meal. Like, there's all this ritual right. of creating a holy, clean, sacred place, separate dishes. So in essence, it wasn't just another dinner. It was a dinner that was intended to be of significance, not because it was his last supper. He was the only one that knew
that. It was Passover.
Table. Yeah. It was a holy day of remembrance of the survival of people and the freedom of. So then to get up as the guest of honor in some ways and walk around the table and do a job. And remember, washing the feet, they didn't like take off their Nike tennis shoes and pull down their socks. They lived on dry and dusty and manure-covered streets that they had walked through and kicked off their shoes before they came in the house. But the rest of them still had the day's dirt and dust and sweat. They didn't take a shower before they got to the dinner and put on fresh clothes. So to do that was that it was a sacred moment because it made it sacred, but it was a nasty little job to be assigned.
Yes.
And the fact that it was a Jewish dinner, he had just, like, wait a minute, you can't come back to this table. Your hands are dirty. There's a whole ritual to getting ready. And he knew all that because he had grown up in that culture. So, yeah, it was not just, oh, I'm going to show you this one little lesson and then we'll go back to eating. It was like, I'm going to flip the table over.
Huge thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I mean, you kind of touched on another topic. You write about hiddenness as something to be valued, maybe even desired, which is definitely countercultural. I mean, we live in a world that is shaped by rewards and visibility. And, you know, what has hiddenness cost you and what has it given you as you discovered this new way of being in your faith?
When I say it's cost me a lot, it was a really good drug of choice. Being on stage, being in front of people, being like, all of that was I walked into a room and the people would go, oh, that's Eric. We need to go talk to him. It's the leadership. Like at one point within the organization, like people were like, he's one of the goats, you know, he's really old. You better live. And so it was really like, I made it. I arrived. Where's my dad? Where's his check sheet? He's got to see this. He's got to fill it up. And so giving that up was giving up at the time what I believed was who I am. It wasn't just a job title or a name on my lanyard when I went into a meeting. It was all of me. Okay. That's how I identified. That's how I breathed. That's how I dressed. That's how everything. And then be like.
So it was identity for you.
Yeah. At a very, when I say deep level, it was like, I didn't know how to be other than the guy that could show up and put on the show, put on the performance. My son still teases me. See, my other son's dork. I was like, please don't use that voice. When he had bought for it, he was, mom boys. And I'm like, oh, sorry. Went into teaching mode for a minute. Got to slide back out. So to give it all up and then not have the next thing ready not have the nuance. Yeah.
Okay.
Like, you know, as an actor, you meet one movie and you have the next role waiting to go through that period of like, okay, I don't have an identity team. I don't exist in the world because I don't know what to tell people I am.
Yeah.
Like, it became very confusing and very, if I don't exist on social media or called for the speaking gig, I don't exist. And if I don't exist, then nobody needs me. And if nobody needs me, then I'm useless. And if I'm useless, then I can just disappear and nobody will care. And that became the very frightening place. But in that couple, I mean, it's, I learned who is watching and who does care. And what it looks like to have somebody come up and go, I see you. Like, I really see you. Like in the Avatar movie type thing. And then walk in and have somebody go, so what do you think? And to not have the pressure of all of that. Oh, daddy, remember to use this language and that language and be this part, like all of that. It was really fun. I sometimes equate it to when you get to switch school districts and your parents say, just know this is a fresh start. You can be whoever you want.
Right.
And you know, you're going to be the popular kid, bro. They forget to tell you how to be the popular kid at the new school. Like you would, you get old school, but it really almost in some ways felt like you get to recreate you. And what do you want that to be? What do you really want that? Like really, really want that to be? And that's
hard. I was definitely never the popular kid. I didn't want to be in high school. That's way too much work.
I was trapped. I have an older sister who was the brain. Like, oh, it's Carolyn. Just give her the 4.0 now. No need to start the class. And then I had a younger son who was the jock who could play basketball and tennis simultaneously. And so I was like, okay, that leaves me a troubled kid. Plasma. I'm not really sure where I fit. So that was kind of the idea I took.
Yeah. So another one of your favorite verses that you mentioned was Matthew 11:28. I think you put 11:28-30, but I kind of picked out 11:28. Come to me, all you are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. And that is such, like, if you really read that verse, just reading it should give you peace. Like, I read it and it makes me feel more relaxed. But you know what? Why is it so hard for us to live in that moment beyond just reading the verse? What makes it so hard for driven, faithful people to actually accept that invitation, in your opinion?
So when I read that, in contract law, there has to be an exchange of goods and services for it to be a contract or a covenant. And so if you come to me, if you pay $100, I will give you this toaster or whatever. If you come to me, I will give you this peace, stillness, comfort. It requires me to do something. Not that his love is included in that. It doesn't say I'll give you love or I'll give you grace. It says I'll give you peace. And so it's like, okay, Eric, in order to move towards something, you have to move away from something. And what would be the most logical move away? The thing that's troubling you, the thing that you're struggling with, the thing that you're battling with. And so even as a non-believer, you would be like, well, duh. If you kind of like walk away from the person that's beating you over the head, it'll stop hurting. He's saying the same thing almost. If you're in pain, if you're struggling, if you're fighting, if you're swimming, I'll be like, oh, come over here. Just take one step in my direction and I will fulfill the rest of the contract and give you. And so it reminds me that when I'm out of sorts, when I'm in that moment of like, oh, it's like, are you willing to give this energy up in exchange for something else, because you can't have both. And some people get so attached to that struggle. I'm struggling for God. I'm struggling to it. Yeah. Are you willing to give up that energy of struggle?
Right.
Right. Whatever it is. Because if you do, and you take a step in the other direction, guess what you gain? And I also see it as, if I take one step, I get this. If I take two steps, I get more of it. And if I like take off running at 90 miles an hour, it's just going to overwhelm me with peace. So that's what I love. Because it's like, Eric, you can sit in this all day long. Or you can give it up and take a step in the next direction. You don't have to go the whole journey, just take a next step.
I like it. This has been such a great conversation, but I don't want to forget to talk about your book. Leadership Was Never My Calling. Now, you did describe it as a confession rather than a leadership book. Who's sitting at the table you're writing for? Like, who is this book for?
Me.
Love it.
The funny thing is, when I started to write it, it started because I heard this word called unleadership. I don't remember where. I apologize, whoever dropped it. And again, because that's my job, I was like, well, what does unleadership mean? Like, what? Like, I've never heard. Like, so I started playing around with the word. And then I said, you know what? What would it look like to unleader your life? To undo this hunt for leadership? So it started way off in a different direction of trying to help leaders, especially faith-based leaders who have gotten consumed by that. You need to be the lead pastor. You need to grow the church. You need to grow like all of that, and teaching them how to disconnect from that word leader. And that's the original title was Leadership Was Never the Calling. Because I was trying to speak to an audience and say, you got it wrong. That's not your calling. That was like 40,000 rewrites a day. Because I would see, this is a good book. But, and then I'd hear a co-writer, well, is it, Eric? Or is it a sage book?
Oof, that's hard.
Well, I'm like, come on, God. I'm just trying to make it marketable. We're just trying to make it available to everybody. Is it? Because? And I could hear that voice of, because if I have a successful book, then it shows my quality as a coach, as a writer, as a book. Like, I was attaching the outcome to my value for my job. And I was like, oh man, do we really need to make this one a teaching lesson? Can't you just leave me? That night. We struggle and wrestle quite often. I'm just screaming. I'm like, can't you just leave me alone? I do not want to do this. So we kind of agreed, or at least I think we agreed in the beginning, that why don't you write it as if you're never going to publish it?
Interesting.
Write it. Just write what it would feel like to just leave that label behind. And so did that, and I was like, no, there's more. Because for me as a writer, I often teach and write through story. And that was the element that was missing. Missing was the character who was experiencing it. And I experimented with all kinds of great leaders who really never fought leadership. And somehow in the rewrites and the rewrites and the rewrites and rewrites, it finally ended up being me talking about what we've just talked about. And then there's entries in it that have my journal notes from that period. And he got finished and I was like, this is a good book. I'm so glad nobody's ever going to see it. I'll feel so much better now that this is out of my system. I can do whatever I want now because, and I use the joke, I've run down the street naked and I even took off my socks. So anything that happens after this book, I cleared the table. Nobody expects anything from me because thank you, God, for giving me that moment to just sit with you and confess and see my life you know. And then it was like, so you don't think this is going to help somebody if they read it? I'm like, no. I was like, really? So I did all of this work with you, all of this talking with you, all of this growing with you, just for you. That selfish of a God that I worked on one-on-ones, though he knows.
I was like, do I have to?
Yes, you do.
Do I have to? Oh, I argue with God all the time.
And it was like,
I always
didn't lose, say you had to go for bestseller. I didn't say you had to do any. You just, if you want to quietly release it into the universe, that's all I'm asking. Your hand on that plow, doing what I ask you to do, or where I'm asking you to do it, and I'll take care of the rest. So it got finished. It's, I don't want to say sitting in a box, but, and in the meantime, as I finished that, all of a sudden it was like, oh, I need to write about this. I need to write. And because I write and ghostwrite for people, sometimes I put projects on hold because working for them. And then I'll come, all of a sudden I was like, I need to write this and I need to write that. It allowed me to step out of needing to make sure everything was perfect and turn it into, is somebody in the room needing this? Is it useful to somebody else? Can I create it in a way that it has value to one person in a group of a million? Oh. So yeah, it's out there. And actually,
there's a companion book, right?
Pardon?
Wounded Faithful. There was a companion book.
Faithful Wounded was supposed to be
a Faithful
Wounded number two, but I was sitting in church. And they were going over a lesson of who needs church. And the story of the four guys that picked up their friend, put him on a mat, and dropped him in.
Dropped him in the hole, yep.
Was mentioned, and it wasn't mentioned as the core story. It was just mentioned about what church can look like if you bring somebody and all that. I thought, wait a minute. Whoa, throw that back, Mr. Pastor Man. I don't know if I have four friends that would do that folder.
Right?
I don't even know what those four people would look like because they didn't ask his permission. He didn't call them and say, I need you to do this. I'll give you $20. They said, we know that just putting you in front of this man named Jesus is what you need. Not for healing. They had no objective except to get him there, to get his butt in the seat at the table. And I was part of a men's group, and it came up in a conversation, and I said, do you guys know who you four are? And we bounced it back and forth, and we've been spending the last 3-5 months trying to figure out what a four looks like. What is the commitment like? What is the requirements like? What is being a four, and so what we use as our code word, mean, and where are we not showing up as a four? And what do we need to do to get ready? And I love it because as men, we often don't think in terms of, I need the guy who's going to pull into a parking lot, see my car, recognize that it's at a bar, and it's on a Saturday night, and my wife isn't with me, and walk in and grab my butt and drag me out of that bar, sit me on the hood of the car and say, I don't care what you do, but as your brother, I'm calling you out and I'm holding you accountable. This is your chance.
Yeah.
Because we're so worried about hurting, offending, and like, do we have...
Yeah.
And none of those guys asked permission. They said, this is what we got to do. Grab a corner, guys. We're off. And they didn't stop when the crowd was too thick. They didn't stop at the door that they couldn't get through. We're like, okay.
They climbed roof, they punched a hole, and they dropped him down.
I mean, can you imagine trying to carry one of your friends up to the roof of a one-story house? And
nope.
Dropped him on, dragged him up by a rope over the edge. I mean, and then tearing up somebody else's house, property damage we'll talk about later.
Right.
We'll pay the cost of a new roof because we're still on mission of getting our friend in front of this guy. And then when it was all over, they all went home. I'm like, I pictured running home and had a beer and went, wow, that turned out better than we had hoped.
Right?
Who's Your Four is coming up for before the
album. Okay.
Just again, because my son is moving in. As I said, I have a daughter, but she's in special services. So sometimes her stories don't align well. But he's moving into that age where he now has to figure out who his four are and build that forwardness as he starts to exit high school and move into adulthood. And he says, you know what? I'm just discovering my four. I want to make sure that he knows what it means to be asked to somebody, be somebody's four.
Yeah. So the message for the listeners is go to lwnc.net and keep checking back, because there's going to be more goodness coming.
No attention to what I think is going to happen.
just keep refreshing.
Yes, because there's a book getting released next week that's just about how to be a better author and brand yourself. It's like, really? Like, if you look at my five-year plan, you'd have to find the trash can.
I don't think I've ever had an actual five-year plan, but that's fine.
I'm blessed to work with writers who are transforming and creating and making impact. And so I might think, oh, I really need to speak to this person, this audience, this group. I can see where they're hungry. And then all of a sudden, God's like, hey, here's the voice I need you to help lift through what I do every day. And by the time they finish whatever their book is, and it can be 3 months or it can be a year, I think, oh, they're going to do a much better job than I could have. Their story, their life, their mission is so much more on point that I have to scrap another book off my list and be like, well, I'm not going to be writing that book because that person does a better job. And that's a really amazing feeling to know.
Absolutely. So, well, I want to wrap this up. Do you have any final words for the listeners today?
I keep stones on my desk. Thinking stones, just hold and fumble. Keeps me from eating. And on one side it says beloved, and on the other side, enough. And I roll that thought through my head often when I'm stuck. It's like, wait a minute, you're enough. And you loved. Is there anything more you really need? Now, you may want a bunch of stuff, but is there anything more you need to get back on task, to get back with me, than to know that when you show up, you are enough and you are loved? And if I had told little Eric that, I can't imagine how much more peace I would have had in life.
Yeah, it's a good message. You are enough. So, Eric, I want to thank you. It's not just for your time. I mean, time is precious. I always tell people I can make more money. I can't make more time. So it's the most valuable thing that anybody can give. But also for the kind of honesty that actually does cost something. It's one thing to write about leadership principles. It's much different to say out loud that the climb left you empty and Jesus is slowly, graciously showing you a better way. And that, I mean, that's the kind of testimony that reaches people who are sitting in a place they really can't name yet. You know what I mean? It's crazy.
Yeah, there are days I wish I was more in tune with it. But there are days I go to bed with a smile on my face, like, man, that was a crappy day. Thank you, God, for letting me be a part of it. Like, well,
yes.
The challenge, because I come equipped differently, I'm not worried about the outcome. I just got to be part of a process that I don't have to manage and control in. Where in the old me, I'd be like, oh my gosh, I got to do damage control in the morning. I got to do this. I got to do this. Got to sign up. Like, I'm just like, go to bed sometime and like, God, why can't you just leave me alone for a day? You just always got to be teaching on me. Always got to be trying to move.
Right.
Always got to. Like, that's why, you know, it's a relationship. It's the best one I got.
Absolutely. It's funny. Romans 10:17 reminds us that faith comes through hearing the message. And I think today, through your story, I believe someone is hearing the message that Maybe they desperately need to hear. The truth that presence is better than performance, a closeness to Jesus is not something you earn by being useful, but the vine does the work and the branch is simply asked to remain, and that you are enough, you are loved and you are enough. So to everyone listening, if today's conversation found you in a tired season, please know that you're not failing. You may just be invited to abide. So go find Leadership Was Never the Calling at lwnc.net. Not my calling, sorry.
Oh, I did you the
Leadership was, you got me confused earlier. Leadership was never my calling.
The work was to bring.
At lwnc.net. Pick up Eric's book and take one honest step back towards Jesus today. He'll meet you there, I promise. I've also included links to his website, social media, all the information that I could find is in today's show notes, so be sure to check that out. Eric, we are so grateful for you. May God continue the good work he has clearly started in you, and God bless you.
Thank you. It was a joy to be here with you. A lot of fun.
Right on. For the rest of the listeners, until next time, keep loving your neighbors, dive into God's Word daily, and may the Lord bless you and keep you and fill you with his peace. Take care, God bless, and we'll see you in the next episode. You've been listening to the My Ministry Mission podcast, hosted by me, Jason McConnell. If today's episode spoke to you, I'd love for you to like, follow, or subscribe me on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss what's next. Be sure to check out this episode's show notes for links and resources from today's conversation. And my prayer for you is this: keep walking with Christ, trusting his plan, and living out the mission God has placed in your heart.